we started Mendel, we basically started with the thesis that a clinical AI is not just any AI, which essentially means you need to have an AI system that is able to understand the nuanced language of medicine, can differentiate when fatigue is a symptom, when fatigue is a side effect, can reconcile data when a pathologist is saying the patient is metastatic, but the doctor is saying stage one, that can also unstructure the unstructured data, couple it with the claims and the structure. We build the coherent patient journey all through an AI system that is able to do that at scale.
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we welcome Karim Galil, co-founder and CEO of Mendel, to the show. Mendel harnesses the power of AI to structure unstructured patient data from sources like pathology reports, genomic data, and claims, building complete patient journeys that reconcile conflicting data points. This consolidated view, accessible through a chat-based interface, empowers healthcare professionals to query and learn from comprehensive patient histories, paving the way for a more objective, data-driven approach to medicine. In this episode, Karim will share his vision for a future where physicians collaborate with ambient AI assistants, much like Iron Man's Jarvis, to streamline documentation, differential diagnosis, and treatment recommendations. He'll also discuss the ethical considerations and the importability in AI systems, ensuring that the decision-making process is transparent and grounded in medical logic. I'm Alex Merwin from AWS, and your host for today's conversation is Yin He, Principal Business Development for Healthcare and Life Sciences Startups. Yin will guide us through Karim's journey, exploring the motivations that led him from practicing medicine in Egypt to founding a company dedicated to indexing medical data and fostering a more consistent, evidence-based approach to patient care. Let's get into it.
Hello, and welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. I'm excited to guest host this session today. My name is Yin He, and I lead our work with early stage healthcare and life sciences startups and investors at AWS. My background is I'm trained as a wet lab scientist, PhD in molecular bio and genomics. And prior to AWS, I was an early employee and operator at a venture-backed startup building cloud labs and software tools to help pharma and biotechs accelerate drug discovery. I'm super excited to be joined today by Karim Galil, CEO and co-founder of Mendel. Karim, welcome. Let's dig in. And I'm looking forward to learning more about your founder journey and how Mendel came to be.
Thank you. Thank you, Ian, for having me on the podcast.
So just to get us kicked off, can you tell us a little bit about Mendel and what you all are doing?
So Mendel is a venture-backed AI company in the clinical space. We essentially help everyone in the healthcare ecosystem who has troves of data to find answers to questions. We always say more truth, less effort. So they're able to get better answers. And I can talk about how we do that, but then also in a faster, more efficient way. So usually our customers have tons of pathology reports, genomic data, structured data, claims, all sorts of modalities. And we combine all of this data in one big patient journey. And then we offer them, think of a chat type of an interface that basically allows them to go through this and ask questions and get answers really fast.
Great. I want to do a little bit of a deeper dive. You know, I think you touched on some of the challenges, but I want to go back. What do you think are the top two most pressing challenges in the industry right now? And then how does Mendel and your products and technology aim to address and solve some of them? If we had to just pick two.
Yeah, I think there's like with early 2000s, we had a problem in healthcare that we didn't have enough data. Like we just didn't have data, right? Everything was paper records. Getting data wasn't a big thing. Then after Obamacare and a lot of incentives on moving to EMR, I think now we have a bigger problem. We have a lot of data. So we moved from no data to actually have a lot of data, but this data remains to be siloed. This data remains to be mainly unstructured and in many different ways is not consolidated. So you would find in one path report, the patient is metastatic, but the doctor claims the patient is stage one. So even if you're able to combine the silos, you still have to go through a lot of stitching to put together a coherent patient journey. And then even if you do that, querying this data becomes incredibly hard. Like writing a SQL query with a lot of business rules can probably take a month or two sometimes, and then full of errors. There's a bunch of problems in putting the data together and querying this data in an efficient way. So I think that's a really big challenge. I think the other challenge is we haven't yet, like when we approach this data, we approach to ask questions about things that we suspect, right? But we don't know what we don't know. So we haven't yet built systems that is able to actually look at the data and start doing hypothesis generation rather than merely responding to human-made or human observations that we think are of relevance. So there's a lot of biomarkers. 10 years ago, we thought they have no contribution to cancer. And now we know that they are the main drivers and there is a bunch of drugs around them. So what else? Like what else is out there in this data that we aren't aware of? So I think those are the two challenges, is like, how can you put the data together? How can you ask smart questions or come up actually with the right questions? To the second half of your question about how we as a company help do that. When we started Mendel, we basically started with the thesis that a clinical AI is not just any AI, which essentially means you need to have an AI system that is able to understand the nuanced language of medicine, can differentiate when fatigue is a symptom, when fatigue is a side effect, can reconcile data when a pathologist is saying the patient is metastatic, but the doctor is saying stage one, that can also unstructure the unstructured data. So those are all things that we do. We basically structure all the unstructured data. We couple it with the claims and the structure. We build the coherent patient journey all through an AI system that is able to do that at scale. Then we've also built a layer on top of it that allows you to interrogate it in a smart way. What we haven't done yet, and we're excited to start working on, is this idea of hypothesis generation. Is can we move from answering questions to actually asking questions? Mm-hmm. And that's an area of research that we're still working on here.
Yeah, I really love just the perspective on going from no data to too much data, right? And then the data is in a very unstructured, unusable format. Everybody talks about AI, ML, right? And even generative AI these days, but it's only as good as the quality of the data. And as you mentioned, being able to know what types of questions you ultimately want to ask the data. That's super interesting. You talk about being able to stitch together this data for the patient journey. I think as a patient, I can understand like why that's really important. But from Mendel, what motivates you all in terms of being able to provide this complete patient journey? What does that truly enable us as patients, as providers, right?
So my background is medicine. I'm a physician by training. And when early in my training, especially around oncology, you always tell the patient, I'll put you in X. We'll see what happens in 6 months. And then we'll decide what we can do after that. It's essentially a Russian roulette type of an approach. Like you try things. And I'm positive, like it's always been irritating because I'm positive that this is not N of one. There is many other patients who have the same exact history, have the same very exact condition. We've probably done our own share of Russian roulette on that patient. Why aren't we able to like learn from those journeys, right? The reason is because even though we have data, we don't have information. And when we have information, we don't have knowledge. And the only way you can unlock all of that, if you actually can put the data together into a patient story, right? Think of every patient as a book. And you want to stitch to, and the chapters of this book is all over the place. So task one is you want to just stitch together the story. And then you want to build as many books as possible. And then you want to build a system that can read all these books and essentially tell you like what works, what didn't work, what patterns have we seen? And you start moving from a very subjective domain to a more objective domain. But essentially, if you look at the practice of medicine, since men started walking on earth, it is a very subjective domain. Yes. That's why you go to a physician that you trust more because you trust their opinions more. Mm-hmm. We use terms like second opinion.
Yeah, I was going to say, now there's an entire business around second opinions. Like, and then there's probably like third opinions, right? On top of that. But ultimately, it's who do you feel trust in, right? In terms of the physician, because I think it's, chances are, right, some of the opinions are going to be highly variable, right? At least on my personal experience.
It's not only that it is highly variable, it's also why would two top oncologists have two different opinions when this patient is the same?
Yeah. So yeah, that's the point.
Something is fundamentally wrong in how we're approaching how we're approaching the domain altogether. And I think big part of it is because we're swimming in data, but we are starving for information and we're starving for knowledge. I think that's what inspired me. We need to move from being subjective to being, I wouldn't say fully objective, but at least semi-objective, because there is still an element of art in how we practice medicine. And there is some nuanced understanding of things that you still have to give weight to, but not 100% of the weight.
Yeah. And where do you think we are in that journey right now in terms of the balance between valuing a doctor's experience versus letting the data tell us what to do?
I think we're definitely super extreme on valuing the physician opinion. And again, I'm not claiming that this is wrong. I'm just saying like there is probably a right balance between the two extremes where it's super data driven or it's super opinion driven. There is probably a balance in between. But I wouldn't say we're doing that because physicians are autistic creatures that just think that their opinions should dominate data. They just don't have access to the data, right? If you ask, and like we were working with a group of oncologists in University of Pennsylvania, and we were showing them our system, and some of my team were like, man, I don't think that they're probably going to say, why do I need this? I just know how do I do my stuff. And then when we showed them the system, the guy was like, wow, I really need this. I would like to ask questions. I want to know what happened last year to all my patients. So actually, physicians are misunderstood. They are willing to look in the data if the data is consolidated, if they have some sort of an easy interface. I remember taking a demo from a big EMR company, and they showed me this interface, and they said, you can ask any question, and we will tell you what happened to your patients. But then they showed me like a Jupyter notebook where I have to ask questions. And I was like, I just felt, man, like I need to get to learn some coding. And it is like, maybe the data is there, it's just not accessible for me. And I'm not going to go learn coding just to do that. So I think this is some of those elements that need to come together so that we enable physicians to actually.
Yeah. I mean, you touched on a great point, right? The data could be available, the technology could be present, but that doesn't mean it's going to get adopted, right? By folks that need a very friendly, you know, user interface. How have you approached that from Mendel? I think, a design perspective, right?
Yeah, as I've mentioned, like I come from a clinical background, and the biggest problem in medicine is adherence, is give the patient the right treatment. The patient just does not adopt the treatment. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the biggest, I forgot the number, but maybe it's like we lose $300 billion a year just because of lack of adherence. Mm-hmm. And don't quote me on this number, but I know it's just an enormous number. And I think the same goes in tech. You can build the best technology ever, but unless you get people to like adopt this technology, you're going to have a lot of issues. And we rely a lot on catering to two users. One we call the power users, and those are data analysts, bioinformaticians, folks like you who has like deep scientific background, and they are willing to sit down and write really complex questions, and they need to be enabled, but they still need to live in code. And we built products essentially for this type of users. And our goal there is to get them to do a job that would take 2 weeks to do it in a day. Think of a copilot type of a thing, and to get better answers. But then we are also building interfaces for what we call the business users or clinical users. Those are essentially folks who are no code. Just want to ask, I want to talk in English and I'm getting an answer. And we build those like language interfaces for them. But then the third thing that we do, and I think it's more important than the interface, is we show evidence. So the biggest issue in AI adoption in healthcare is even like, you're a scientist, you're trained to look at the tree of logic of whatever conclusion you're given. You just cannot take a conclusion and run with it. So the biggest problem we see in AI today is the lack of explainability, especially when you have a deep learning only approach. And we have invested a lot of research in actually showing our end user, whether it's a power user or a clinical user, the evidence. And one of our customers said, this is a 100% explainable system in a report that they submitted. And that's exactly what we aim for, is to show how did the AI reach that conclusion, and to our own detriment sometimes. Like sometimes it's actually the wrong conclusion, but we're giving them the tools to figure this out. Mm-hmm. But I think even folks appreciate when they see the errors, if the company enables them to do that, actually increases adoption a lot. So those would be the three things we do around the adoption piece.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I think the things that folks are most skeptical of is when it's a black box, right? There's some input that goes in and then just some output, and nobody knows what's happening in between, and that it's a truly black box. But once you're able to cite the source, right, maybe a piece of literature or a study that was done, again, as you mentioned, right, even if it's not necessarily the same conclusion they would have made, or perhaps even the wrong conclusion, right? In certain cases, being able to tie it back to the evidence is so important. And I think by doing more and more of that, we're able to get folks right up on the adoption curve. And so at some point, hey, I trust the system, right? I've been able to validate it. I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of times, right? People need to do this. But yeah, being able to just let people look inside this black box, this black magic, right, that people think is AI, which it isn't, right? It's being trained on tons and tons of data. but allowing people to map it back to what that source of truth is so important. That kind of goes to my next question is, what do you say to clinicians or patients that aren't quite ready to embrace AI, right? We see tons of surveys. We probably go to the same healthcare conferences, right? At Health and Vibe, and there's always this huge screen showing a survey of the audience where people are in their AI adoption and journey. And there's a lot, right, that just aren't ready. What do you say to folks like that when you encounter them during the course of talking about Mendel?
I think my answer would be a little bit controversial, especially that I run an AI company. But I would say, my argument here is, I wouldn't say people should not adopt AI. I absolutely wouldn't say that. I mean, I wouldn't be starting an AI company myself if that's the case. But I would say people should, especially on the healthcare side, look, like I had dinner a few weeks ago. I got the honor to have dinner with the president of ASCO, the American Society of Oncologists, and basically have access to almost every oncologist in the US. And we were talking about the dangers of AI. And I was like, yeah, if AI is trained on the wrong data, this would happen. I actually had a more pessimistic view around like AI on the clinical side. But then he goes, look, at the end of the day, a doctor is going to write a prescription and he's responsible for that prescription. You cannot tell me that a doctor never received a wrong pathology report. There's so many errors that the doctor received every day, and they are trained to validate. They are trained to double check. They understand that their responsibility. So his point is, you shouldn't worry that much because AI is not perfect. Neither is anything else in healthcare. But it is our job as physicians to validate and to sign. And once we sign, it's our responsibility. So at the end of the day, the buck stops with the prescriber. So to that extent, then prescribers need to have better understanding of how to trust, how to pick an AI system. And the example I always give is when I wanted to propose, I obviously didn't know how to pick a diamond ring. For me, a diamond or a piece of glass would look exactly the same. And then my wife now had to basically educate on like, wow, there just turned out to be a whole science around that. And now I know what questions to ask when I go buy a piece of diamond. I don't do that as frequent as I should, but
that's a useful skill. The four C's. It's important.
And I think it's the same thing for everyone. A good AI system or a bad AI system is like a diamond versus glass in some fashion. Mm-hmm. And they don't know the right criteria, questions to ask. What data was this AI system trained on? Is it trained on Reddit or is it trained on actual medical records? Mm-hmm. What about the biases in the data that it was trained on? Even if it was trained on medical records, is it trained on one specific race? Or there's so many different questions. Now, away from that, how can I validate the AI? Is it explainable? Who's the team behind it? There's so many different questions that I feel clinicians today and the buyer in general, trust me, even on the pharma side, the buyer, most of our work is with enterprises and very few times where we see the buyer able to ask the right questions. And I think that's the biggest challenge that we're going to have. And till we figure that, I feel people need to be a little bit cautious on using an AI system. Because look, like if you think during the opioid crisis, had we collected a lot of data, trained a machine learning model on top of this data, probably this model would be overprescribing opioids today, thinking that it is doing the right thing. It learned from humans something incorrect. You can't blame the model. The model saw the patterns in the data. So how can you solve problems like this? How can you solve problems where the data actually, the model did the right thing based on the data, but the data is not ethical or the data is not following the latest guidelines?
Yeah, so I know it's an unsolved problem, but what steps can folks take to get upskilled and educated, right? This isn't stuff that's happening in medical school or when you're doing your PhD research, right? Are there like tactical things people can do?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things on that. One is, there is a whole era where moved from diagnosing cancer as an organ, like it's a lung cancer, to like now talking about non-small cell lung cancer with certain biomarker. And oncologists weren't trained on biomarker or like precision medicine when they were in school, but they saw the value that that would bring to the patient. And that incentivized everyone to start going to conferences, learn about those things and read. And they actually, this is what doctors are really good at, self-educating themselves. Mm-hmm. That's what they're trained to do. As long as they see the incentive that there is some better patient care that would be given. That's why they went to med school in the very first place. And I see a lot of physicians now realizing that there is some benefit for the physicians and it's going to be a function of time for us. I think the second part of the question is, great, now when they go to learn, companies that are building AI have a lot of responsibility around their marketing. And talking about the limitations is not something that you see AI companies doing. Mm. they're only talking about the upside, never about the limitations. And I think there is a moral responsibility if you are in the domain of healthcare. I don't care if you're doing AI and fintech, that's a different story. I'm not suggesting you shouldn't, but your responsibility goes 100x more when there's a patient involved at the end of the day to actually explain what it can do and what it cannot do. And I think that's, even if physicians are willing, there is a responsibility on companies to do that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think this is what happens when there's sort of regulatory bodies are trying to play catch up a little bit, right? With new technologies that are just off to the races, especially with Gen AI, there's just so much evolution and development, right? On every single day, right? If you follow the news. And when it comes to drugs, right, and therapeutics, there's just so much oversight over the type of language and marketing and everything. And you're right, for AI products, there's nothing, right, that's even close to that faith. And I think it's so important to think about how we develop and build these technologies responsibly, especially as you mentioned in this industry, right, where at the end of the day, it's not just a piece of software or an app, right? It actually will impact human lives. So speaking of, you know, ethics and responsibility, how do you all approach product development in such a way where you think about ensuring that the technology is accurate, right, to the best of your ability and that it's used, right, responsibly in the market?
There's two-pronged approach to that. One is obviously policies around our marketing, policies around how do we describe the product, how we get our salespeople to talk about it. And there is a lot of this more soft type of policies that we have to guard against this. But then there is a core technical approach here from day one, which is an LLM-only approach or a deep learning-only approach is never going to be explainable to the extent that you want. It's always going to be hallucinating, and it's always going to be a function of the data that you have. Even if it's a really big data, it's going to be a function of like how, again, how ethical was the data to begin with, which you're not going to, as a human, be able to sit and read every single record if you want to train on terabytes of and petabytes of data. So what we have done essentially is we have a coupling approach where we have built Hypergraph. Think of a knowledge representation that has a lot of the logic that you would have in medicine coded into that knowledge graph. And it sits on top of the deep learning and it acts as a filtering mechanism that whenever the LLM would say, that I'm not suggesting it would do that, but the patient had headache in the knee, it would tell you you cannot get a headache in the knee. And that's not coherent, or a patient cannot be metastatic and at the same one, stage one. So it's a tree, and it's not a rule-based system because those systems wouldn't scale in a domain like medicine. There is always edge cases. But we got inspiration from the alphabet. If you think of every word we have, it's driven from the same alphabet. Every compound we have is driven from the same periodic table. So there is a lot of power in abstraction, and we were able to, over the years, build an abstraction layer that abstracts a lot of the logic that you would expect. Think of the laws of physics in medicine. And it sits on top of the LLM and acts as that filtration layer. It also allows you to see the tree of decision making, so offers you that explainability. So that is a core piece of the work that we have done here, is we don't have a deep learning only approach. We couple it with that Hypergraph, and we think this is a clinically responsible model, essentially.
And for that model, have you looked at hallucinations or things like that to be able to try and assess how often it happens?
So it doesn't hallucinate, because if the LLM hallucinated, the Hypergraph or that knowledge representation would basically detect and correct. That being said, I'm not suggesting it's an accurate system. When it is wrong, it is consistently wrong. And when it is right, it is consistently right. The problem with hallucinations is not the fact that the system errored. It's the fact that the system errored after I trusted the system. Like, it did it 10 times correctly, and now it didn't do it correctly. So now I didn't check. It gets your guards down. It becomes like a toss of a coin. Am I going to get it right or wrong? And I think every AI system will still have a room of error, and humans do have rooms of error. But it is way more acceptable in a domain like medicine to have a consistent error that you can also trace back and fix. The other problem with machine learning is like how many parameters you have in a big LLM. How can you go fix something is not an easy thing. It's not a function of a sprint. It's a function of a lot of R&D. When you have that sort of a Hypergraph, you're still working on that long shot stuff on the machine learning side, but there's quick fixes you can do in that Hypergraph that immediately solves a problem. And again, takes you on a track where you're consistently right or you're consistently wrong.
Yeah, it's like when I worked in automation where we were trying to use code to generate protocols, right, and have it execute on automation. If there was an error in the code, it would be reproducible, right? But it would happen at the same time over and over. So at least you could go back and trace it. Whereas if humans were doing it, if you made a mistake, you would have, you know, no idea that ever happened. And it would just be something unexplainable in the data, but you wouldn't, again, be able to trace it back to that. Yeah.
Exactly.
Cool. I want to switch gears a little bit. I want to maybe back up a little bit and say, imagine we can time travel like 15 years into the future. What do you hope like healthcare and the patient journey and healthcare delivery and access looks like? Big question.
I was just fortunate enough to get in one of those Apple Vision Pros. And I had an AI interface to ask questions, like think of the Mendel interface to ask questions. And I can still see. I was thinking like, I probably can be able to sit in front of a patient. Obviously, if it becomes smaller, better than how it looks, because it looks a little bit creepy now. I think to pick out patients. But if it's like more...
You see those people, yeah, like on the street, yeah, exactly. Like those memes of folks on the street.
I think it's going to be a collaboration between a human brain and a very smart system. It's almost like the Iron Man, like Jarvis and Iron Man type of a relationship, where the physician is going to be sitting down. They're not going to have to do a lot of transcription. They're just going to be talking to the patient and the AI is inputting the data in the EMR. But they're also not trying to do differential diagnosis by trying to retrieve every piece of information they have learned in the past. They will still do that, but the AI would be doing this also on the spot. They're also going to have way better treatment options, all happening in a very ambient way rather than the physician has. I think it's going to be a combination of that, a combination of very advanced AI systems that are acting in an ambient way, but also are in a collaboration relationship. I like the Tesla model of like having an autonomous car that you still need your hands on the wheel. I don't like the Google model of like, we're going to have a car that's going to drive from X to Z, don't even have a steering wheel in the machine itself. I think it's specifically in the domain of medicine. It's like I was once told, patient trusts their priest, their significant other and their doctor. And it basically talks about there is a very strong relationship between a physician and a patient that goes beyond just merely a transaction of here's your drug, here's your diagnosis. And this is going to have to still, we are humans at the end of the day, and this is going to live with us.
Yeah. And I think there's studies where there's right in underserved populations where there isn't that trusting relationship, right? Basically just the amount of sort of the rate of health, right, to completely deteriorate. So that relationship is absolutely essential to maintain the standard of care, right, and to try to create healthiness within the local community. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't touch a little bit on your background. You alluded to that you were a physician, but I'd love to learn more about your background and what inspired you to build Mendel in the first place.
I got my training in Cairo, Egypt. And the way it works there, it's a free healthcare system. So you graduate, you are a physician, bam, you have to start seeing patients. And it wasn't the most pleasant experience to sit in front of a patient that has a terminal illness and you're like lost. And then you go to two like senior physicians and they have different opinions. And that never sat well with me. So I was lucky my father was working as a diplomat in the US. So I got to travel with him here. And I thought, this is the promising, like, this is the land. This is where I'm going to come in and learn, like, objective medicine. And it was quickly the same experience. It's just better, probably, like, cleaner hospitals, better machinery, but it's the same craft. It's the same Russian roulette at the very core of it. So that's when I decided, like, someone is going to start a company, like, that is going to index medical records and that's actually going to start gleaning insights out of it. And I would like to be that, one of those people who would attempt it. And I think there will be a Mendel. I hope Mendel is the company, but there will definitely be a company that's going to look at all the medical records and make sense out of it, because that's the pattern in history. When we invented books, we invented libraries. When we invented the internet, we invented Google. When now we have invented medical records, we're going to have to invent that type of a company that looks at all the data. But I was so naive. They say great companies are started by naive people. I had no clue what unstructured data is, what AI is. Had I known what I know now, probably I wouldn't have started the company, but I think that kind of worked out that you are able to dive deep and figure it out as it goes.
Yeah, that's what we hear a lot, right? It's the resilience. It's continuing to question the status quo and not taking the answer that this is the way it is, right, as an answer and continue to probe and remaining really hungry and curious and resilient, I think, above all. If you were to give some future aspiring entrepreneurs some advice here, what would you say?
I think he said it like super well said. I think it's the future is for the resilient, because it's just, I think Elon Musk was saying that one of his friends was telling him it's like walking in the valley of death and eating glass or something like this. And I think it is actually like that. Like the good days, like when you have good news, you celebrate for a minute, but then you're bombarded by 10 other. Your job essentially is to solve problems.
Yeah. There's always fires, right?
Yeah. You're solving problems for your employees, for the market, for the universe at some times, right? So having the resilience to always be in a problem solving mood and understanding that probably if you succeed in solving 20% of those problems, you are a great entrepreneur, and you have to come in peace with that 80% of those problems are just not going to be solved and you have to walk your way around them. It takes a lot of resilience. I think resilience is the key, and it only comes in if you have passion to the problem. I don't think resilience is, if you're really passionate about a problem, you will find that in you. Mm-hmm. You'll find the energy.
You took the word out of my mouth. I was going to say passion. I think what comes straight through from you is also having just that personal journey through the healthcare space and seeing, hey, there's so many things that are broken here. We have the tools and the technology. Why can't we cobble them together and try to take a stab at solving this problem? Wonderful, Kareem. It was such a pleasure having you on. Thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your story. And we look forward to staying in touch.
Awesome. Right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.